Okay, so why don't I just start in the interest of moving along, because I was going to start, as I said, said to Matt, with a little historical reminiscence about how we got to where we are and the topic known as ADS-CFT. But before I do that, let me thank the organizers for their invitation and for their hard work in getting this conference to happen. And of course, the KITP too for its hard work. So where did ADS-CFT come from? It was, you know, in 1974 that Atwoft had this dream of a large N genus expansion for a QCD that convinced many people that there must be some string underlying the large N expansion at any rate. But it really was not for 20 years that we had the right tools in string theory to attack it full on. And the primary tool was dBrains, introduced right here at the KITP by your very own Joel Polchinski. And the crucial feature about a dBrain is that it carries a gauge degree of freedom. The next observation that was crucial was from Witten, that multiple coincident dBrains generalize that gauge symmetry from just a U1 to an arbitrary UN gauge group, and you could get other gauge groups with tricks. So that was the real start of it. Coincident dBrains, many coincident dBrains, naturally lead to a non-abelian gauge symmetry, non-abelian gauge dynamics. So it just must be that that is the right venue for string theory to study gauge theories. And so it proved. The next watershed, to my mind, was this work of Strominger and Vaffa on counting black hole microstates. That was the first time where it was a crucial connection was made between the gauge dynamics on dBrains, in this case, intersections of D1 brains and D5 brains, for instance. A connection was made between that gauge theory and then the back reaction geometry around the dBrains. So you have two alternative pictures. You have the supergravity description, which says how do the dBrains tug on spacetime, and then you have the gauge dynamics, which says roughly how do the open strings move on the dBrains. And Strominger and Vaffa succeeded in making a very precise dictionary between microstates on the gauge theory side and Bekenstein-Hawking entropy on the supergravity side. That doesn't sound much like QCD. We're talking about 1+1 dimensional gauge theories or field theories. So, you know, it didn't really come to the attention, let's say, of the QCD community, and rightly so. But it could be generalized to the D3 brain. You could do a microstate calculation for the D3 brain, and you could find an entropy which agreed with the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy up to some small numerical factor. And that was a calculation that at least convinced me that there really was something deep going on that was maybe tractable and we could really see gauge dynamics from supergravity. Of course, the really important crucial piece of the puzzle that was missing was Maldacena's realization that it was the near horizon geometry that completely encoded the gauge dynamics, and this asymptotically flat part that we're used to thinking about so much was irrelevant. So it was that limit of just focusing in on the near horizon geometry that allowed us to make a big leap forward into what is now this ADS-CFT duality, there was quickly put forward a recipe for computing any correlator. There were put forward recipes for computing Wilson lines. It was understood that you could describe confinement with deformations of anti-de Sitter space. Many things followed. And it looks like I have my projector. Many things followed. And I'm going to tell you about one of them today, which is based primarily on work with Igor Klebanov and Chris Herzog. Chris is a postdoc here at the KITP, And if I'm not available to answer a question, I'm sure that he knows quite as much as I do about our calculations. If I have time, I'll mention also some work with a Princeton undergraduate, Jonathan Heckman, on spinning black holes. It harks back to the black hole entropy origin of ADS-CFT, and may be of some interest to people thinking about gauge theories in three dimensions. Pardon me, 3+1 dimensions. Fine, so here's my little spiel in writing with references. I'll leave it to you to look it up on the web if you want to see what I think of the landmarks or some of the landmarks. One that I left out in my verbal presentation was Polyakov's evolving thinking about non-critical strings in warp geometries. So he almost had it, but didn't have it in type 2B string theory, where it turned out to be most fruitful. Well, again, this is things I've already summarized, and if you want to read a longer version of the history as well as a fairly comprehensive summary of the duality up to 1999, there's this review that may still be of some use. So it's a wonderful subject, I hope I've conveyed, but we can't yet solve QCD with it, and the reason is that we rely too much still on supergravity. That's for a very good reason. In supergravity, you can calculate reliably when your spacetimes are weakly curved. Well, what do you need for that? You need for the number of brains to be enormous. You have a D3 brain, you duplicate it a million times, and then its back reaction on the surrounding geometry becomes weakly curved, just like a large Schwarzschild black hole, weak curvature. That's where we can calculate, but of course that's where the Tuff coupling becomes large, so just as soon as you get control over the closed string side, the gravity side, you lose control over the open string side. We could regain control at small Tuff coupling if we could quantize strings effectively in backgrounds with Ramon-Ramon flux, such as comes from D-brains, but that's proven to be a technically very challenging problem, and we don't have an efficient calculational framework yet. And then, of course, another reason, which will be really the focus of my talk today, why we can't just go and solve QCD is that these constructions where you have coincident D-brains and you get gauge symmetry and so forth, they also give rise to matter fields. So to give you an example of why there has to be matter fields, D-brains in space-time, they break a translational symmetry, and so there's got to be some Goldstone bosons associated with that translation. All right, so that's it for my introduction. I'm now going to tell you about strings on the warped deformed conifold in qualitative terms, because that is the venue for my discussion of a confining background that nevertheless doesn't have a mask out. So in pictures, here are our coincident D3 brains. Their world volume is a copy of R3,1. The transverse space in the simplest setup is just a copy of flat six-dimensional space. The integral through the unit S5 surrounding our D-brains is a number of D-brains. Oh, thank you. A pointer. Okay, so this is the literally simplest setup that you can do for ADS-CFT, leading you to the simplest, shall we say, the simplest of all field theories, N equals 4, SUN, super Yang Mills. But there's an obvious way of spicing this up. It was tried rather early on, and that is to put these coincident D-brains on a singular point of the underlying manifold. So you replace this R6 by some Calabi-Yau space like the conifold. This is not quite what we want because there's no scale. There's no scale in this picture. Nothing says there's an intrinsic length here away from the tip. And it may not come then as a surprise to you that the conformal field theory arising from the open strings on the D3 brains is conformal. But when you learn that conformal field theory has a product gauge group, something might immediately occur to you let's just take the variant where the product gauge group becomes two unequal factors. And then you're sure that there's no way you could get the beta function of this to be zero at the same time that the beta function of this is zero. Indeed, that's impossible. And instead, what goes on is that this guy gets stronger in the infrared, whereas this guy gets weaker, up to a certain point. And at that point, where essentially this coupling goes to infinity, there's a Seiberg duality. And this large gauge group is replaced by something that's actually smaller than the second guy. So we cascade through many Seiberg dualities. And this is part of the Klebanov-Strassler picture. The other part on the supergravity side is that adding M to one of the gauge groups amounts to adding another string theory flux, another mode of the closed string to the geometry that's describing these D3 brains. That extra flux is this one. And when you have this flux through an S3, it forces that S3 to remain a finite size. And that's the deformation of the counterfold. This is, in fact, a totally smooth manifold, and its boundary is this S3 cross S2. This is not a boundary. We're just talking about fibrations, so that the last fiber is a finite size S3. Topologically, it's the cotangent bundle of S3. And certain Bianchi identities force the integral of F5 over the boundary to depend on how far you are from the blunted end of the counterfold. And this R-dependent number of degrees of freedom is a manifestation of that Seiberg cascade. As you go further and further down in energy, or further and further in radius, the number of degrees of freedom decreases. So here I've just tried to indicate that decrease in a special case through many steps of the Seiberg cascade. And the charming fact is that the last step leads you to pure SUM n equals 1 gauge theory. So here's my cartoon sketch of this whole situation. There's some very distant ultraviolet boundary of a nearly anti-de-Sitter space. And this is where, if you like, the microscopic theory lives. And then there's some slow Seiberg duality cascade until you finally get to the far, far infrared, and you're left with only SUM, and then, whoops, you couldn't find. So we would say, must be a mass gap. There's certainly a mass gap in SUN, n equals 1, pure glue. Many people thought for years that the Klebanov-Strassler geometry exhibited a mass gap. But Aharoni knew better. He said, no, wait, there's a Goldstone boson. So the situation is charmingly like QCD in the real world, where pions sit well below the confinement scale. Except here, it's really an exact symmetry that generates this Goldstone boson, and I'm going to tell you about it. The exact symmetry has to do with the matter fields that go away in that last step of the Seiberg cascade. So you're really losing something important when you do that last step. And so in order to understand what's really going on, we should Seiberg cascade almost all the way down to the penultimate theory, SU2M cross SUM. And I have to tell you a little bit more about that theory to explain to you why there's really a Goldstone boson. So the matter content is chiral superfields A and B, which have quantum numbers not only under the gauge groups, but under some global symmetry groups. And the quantum numbers are arranged in just such a way that you can build some gauge singlet baryon operators, B and B bar. So it's crucial that I had SU2 as a global symmetry, because I used both the A1s and the A2s, at the same time that I had SU2M cross SUM, because here the upper indices are the SU2M indices, and the lower indices are the SUM indices. So, you know, my factors have conspired to make these operators exist. And it's understood that this deformed conical geometry corresponds to the so-called baryonic branch of the gauge theory, and it's characterized in terms of the non-perturbative superpotential as VV bar equals minus a dynamically generated scale to an appropriate power. Okay, so once you've written down this equation and you've said that you're describing a baryonic branch of the gauge theory, now you can really understand why Ahrens jumped up and said there's no mass gap. It's because there's a broken global symmetry U1 baryon. So let's now recall how this Goldstone boson must in principle show up in supergravity. And I should start by telling you about the Glueball calculations that Professor Kuti alluded to. In supergravity, you've got your anti de Sitter space. Well, it's really a deformed anti de Sitter space. And you know, it's a finite extent in the infrared direction. And you've got some massless supergravity fields. Phi could be the graviton. There's some scalars like the dilaton. Anyway, there's some massless fields floating around in five dimensions. And there's standing waves of these massless fields in this geometry. It's actually of infinite extent in this direction, but it only takes a finite affine parameter to reach the boundary. So this is a correct Penrose diagram, but not very geometrically illuminating. Anyway, the bottom line is there are standing waves of finite energy. And those standing waves are the Glueballs. To say that there is a Goldstone boson in this language must mean that a particular mode here of the supergravity fields manages to have no energy from the radial direction. So we're looking for a radial zero mode. And this was something that seemed to escape notice despite there being many studies of the Glueball spectrum for the Klebanov-Strasser geometry. But if you think about it right, you're quickly led to the right guess. The right guess is to say to yourself, the Goldstone boson is some pseudoscalar, let's call it A, obeys a free wave equation. And an efficient way to express that is to say that the exterior derivative is the four-dimensional Hodge dual of a closed three form. Okay, but we have a closed three form. I've already mentioned it. It's this F3 thing at me that had flux through the three sphere. So you might say to yourself, I know a good candidate ansatz for a Goldstone boson. It should just be some perturbation in this three-form field that came to me in supergravity. And after a certain amount of pain and suffering, we managed to add the additional terms necessary to actually solve the linearized equations of motion. And indeed, you get a normalizable mode, and it has zero energy as expected. Well, this was an ansatz that really came to us from a different direction. The way we came at it was we were thinking to ourselves, what is the D1 brain? Well, a better way to say the question is, what does the D1 brain in this geometry correspond to in the gauge theory? How do we understand this thing in terms of four-dimensional gauge theory physics? Well, spilling the beans ahead of time, I'll just tell you that the D1 brain is the object that carries the electric charge of this three-form field strength. Or another way of saying it, if you're talking about four-dimensional quantities, is that it carries a magnetic charge of this one-form field strength. So this D1 brain should be a solid tonic string, and A experiences some monodromy around it. I've indicated here, you know, the term and the action that tells you that the D1 brain carries some charge under F3. Well, that leaves us with some natural questions, and I'll spend the rest of my time just trying to clean up the loose ends that arise from this little computation. We've preserved n equals 1 supersymmetry, and so this Goldstone boson that we constructed, we knew had to be there because of the D1 brain. It has some superpartners, not only fermions, but also a real scalar, a massless scalar, which has to be, therefore, a modulus. In other words, there's some hitherto unknown deformation of the warped deformed conifold corresponding to this superpartner. Well, in order to try to find this thing explicitly, we should look at its properties. First of all, it preserves the SO4 symmetry of that S3 factor in the geometry, because so do the Goldstone boson. Intuition says that it should certainly comprise perturbations of Nevis-Schwartz fields, because the Goldstone boson had to do with the Ramondre-Mode fields. And that intuition comes from comparing with, say, the complexified coupling of type 2b supergravity. And then another additional technical restriction is that there's a particular Z2 symmetry. It has to do with exchanging the matter fields A and B that should not be respected by this modulus. Maybe a better way of saying this is that I told you that BB bar equals some constant. Solutions of that equation can clearly be generated by starting with one solution and then rotating by a phase. B goes by one phase and B bar goes by the opposite phase. But another thing to do is just to make B smaller and B bar bigger. And whereas B was constructed from the A's, B bar was constructed from the B's. So we're treating the A's and the B's asymmetrically. Well, that's all we know offhand about this scalar modulus, and so we searched for some deformation of supergravity that would again solve the linearized equations, and this is what we came up with. Strangely enough, it did not involve the dilaton. That was a surprise to me. And by plugging these things back into the Einstein equation and so forth, you can find a solution explicitly which is normalizable. Now the interesting thing is that, well, interesting thing to an algebraic geometer perhaps, is that this deformation here is what one does to resolve the conifold. Obviously, I haven't told you enough to know what these one forms, G1, G3, G2, G4 are, but those are details. They have to do with the S2 cross S3 part of the geometry, and tau is equivalent to the radial direction. Anyway, there is another way of deforming the conifold called resolution, and we seem to be simultaneously resolving and deforming when we turn on this modulus. And so we're actually left with a new insight, surprisingly, about Calabi-Yau compactifications, that after turning on the Ramondre-Mode flux, you can resolve a warped deformed conifold. Well, there's some things that we haven't done, or things that I haven't told you. One thing that I haven't done, really, is to show rigorously that the Nevis-Schwartz perturbation I just explained is the superpartner of the Goldstone mode that was so obvious. Nor have we obtained this resolved warped deformed conifold explicitly past the first order in perturbation theory. Nor have I explained to you how your naive intuition about there being a mass gap in SUN gauge theory went wrong for this theory. So that's something we do understand. Let me tell you about it with this picture. Supergravity describes a regime where the dynamically generated scales associated with each step in the Seiberg cascade are rather close by. So it's like a finite factor from one to the next. And that's quite in contrast with what you would naturally want to use in perturbation theory, where you would have a wide separation of scales, where this scale dynamically generated for the penultimate theory is such that the coupling of SUM is very weak here, so it takes a long time to run down to the confining scale. Here, in the supergravity description, once you've gone through the Seyberg cascade, you're very close to the confinement transition. And that's the way in which supergravity tells you in this geometry that you've got to go to weak coupling before you can cleanly describe a confining gauge theory. Cleanly, in this case, means without a Goldstone boson. But wait, there is a Goldstone boson here. It's just that its couplings are suppressed by a factor of this dynamically generated scale. So to say that the Goldstone boson goes away merely means that it decouples. Here it's very much part of the geometry. Its interactions are unsuppressed. And it would totally interfere with a quantitative description of glue balls, say, in n equals 1 QCD from this warp-deformed conifold story. All I'm getting at is that supergravity cannot be tricked. String theory cannot be tricked. You have to go to some limit where there's weak coupling in the problem from the word go before you can cleanly describe QCD as a string theory. Another loose end that we understood, at least in qualitative terms, is what happens to our Goldstone boson after we compactify, say, with a warp-deformed conifold here and a warp-deformed conifold here and some big, huge Calabi-Yau with topology. And there usually has to be some orientifold planes to soak up the flux. So the qualitative question is, you've got a Goldstone boson, but in a theory of gravity, what happens to it? When you add gravity, what happens to it? Well, it's got to be Higgsed. The reason is that every global symmetry turns into a local symmetry when you compactify your theory. With no further reasoning, you would say to yourself that the Goldstone mechanism turns into an abelian Higgs mechanism, and the modulus field that I just told you about a couple of transparencies ago acquires some mass, say, M Higgs. And this M Higgs is going to be the same as the mass of the vector particles because of supersymmetry. Well, we tried to calculate this M Higgs and had a little trouble, I must confess. But at least it seems clear that this ratio here, maybe I should have written lambda sub M, this ratio has power law behavior in the flux numbers. So this is not a way to get an exponentially suppressed mass. In short, the modulus problem does not rear its head all over again because of these normalizable modes on the warp-deformed conifold. Okay, so I've got a bit of time left, right? How much time? Wow, I'm going fast. I think I'll finish early, but let me tell you about another project that I did with Jonathan Heckman, who is an undergraduate at Princeton and is now a graduate student at Harvard. This has nothing to do immediately with confinement, but it does have to do with something a little reminiscent, and that is that we find from supergravity some prediction of a gap in the dimensions of operators in a situation that I'll describe as I proceed. The venue now is to go back to ADS5 cross S5, the simplest, easiest situation, and consider black holes in entity de Sitter space with some angular momentum in the S5 directions, as I've drawn. Well, there's three independent ways to give such a black hole angular momentum, and the three independent ways correspond to the Cartan subalgebra of SO6. These three charged black holes are an anti-de-Sitter version of the old D1, D5 Kaluza-Klein system that's very dear to our hearts because it's in a way where ADS-CFT began. These old papers by Strominger and Vafa and Cowan and Maldacena, they were, as I said at the beginning, the first examples of where you could get a map between open string dynamics on one hand and closed string entropy on the other. So we want to revisit this topic with the power of ADS-CFT in our hands. Well, the upshot of our work is quickly stated. The salient thermodynamic properties of these small black holes in anti-de-Sitter space can be roughly understood in terms of effective strings, in short, the same language that was used by Strominger and Vafa. To see how it arises, I have to remind you that Myers and Taffyard showed that these spinning black holes could be described in terms of many D3 brains wrapping the S5 in a non-topological fashion and spinning in some direction perpendicular to the directions that they wrap. So that the, you know, this is already in some sense a description of the microstates, but not detailed enough to tell you about thermodynamics. All right, so one such distribution of parallel D3 brains wrapping the S5 will tell you about one charge, one of these U1s of the black hole. In order to get multiply charged black holes, you have to consider orthogonal distributions. And when there are orthogonal distributions, say some horizontal and some vertical, there are intersections of these D3 brains, and the intersections happen to be over a one-dimensional surface, you know, something with one-dimensional spatial extent. This is the effective string. And I remind the cognoscenti that this picture compactified on a T5 would be a subcase of the Strominger-Vafa story. You would say that that this string has many deformation parameters. If you excite then some momentum along the string, you can count the number of BPS states, and that's how you wind up getting the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. Well, on T5, that story is very clean, totally supersymmetric, and totally calculable. On S5, it's not too different. The claim is that we can reproduce entropies and temperatures up to factors of order 1, and those factors of order 1 are hard to calculate, perhaps because the S5 is curved, but perhaps also because of something I'm about to tell you that's very surprising and perhaps ugly, but we'll find out. Let's work up to this big difference gradually, the big difference between flat space and anti-de-Sitter space. When you actually want to look at where the black hole horizon is, it's determined in terms of a particular function that appears in GTT. Think of F as just the TT component of the metric. So it's some function that looks like 5D Schwarzschild, that's this term, plus a lot of extra junk that has to do with the charges of the black hole and with the ADS radius L. Every expression in this equation has a CFT analog. For instance, this mu, which would be Schwarzschild mass if there weren't any charges at all, this mu turns into dimension. Or more properly, it turns into dimension minus the charges when there are charges. And these QIs, which are the natural parameters describing charge and supergravity, they turn into CFT R charges. I've maintained the notation JI just because it reminds me that they came from momenta on the S5. So if only one of these charges is non-zero, then for arbitrarily small mu, there's still a horizon. That's what this picture tries to indicate. for mu strictly zero, the function at the top of the page is always positive. So there's no horizon. You have a singular geometry. But any mu greater than zero leads to, clearly, leads to a function f with a zero for some positive r. Now on the CFT side, the operators that must correspond to the microstates of this black hole are operators which have rather large dimension and rather large j, but rather small difference, and I'll call that r twist in imitation of the twist that comes up in deep inelastic scattering. For instance, if we're thinking of something that's r twist zero, there's an example of an operator that does it. Every z has dimension one and an r charge one. And this operator would correspond to this supersymmetric but singular black hole in energy distributed space. So all we're doing is we're just turning on a little bit of r twist and forming a horizon. And so there should be exponentially many operators as you increase the r twist, but nevertheless keep it small compared to delta or J1. So this exponential here just reflects the fact that there should be some macroscopic entropy. The macroscopic entropy is a log of this. And what you find is that the temperature which you measure in supergravity is the Hawking temperature of the horizon, can be described in terms of the giant graviton picture as the Hagedorn temperature of the effective string. So that's one of Heckman's and my main points, is that you really do have a quantitative handle on the microstates, again up to a factor of order unity, say right there, that we would certainly hope to do better with at some time. When you have two charges, now, yes?
So how do you estimate the Hagedorn temperature?
Leo Pendelzayas asks, how do you estimate the Hagedorn temperature? What you have to know is the tension and the number of degrees of freedom. The number of degrees of freedom we estimate in the same way that you would for the Strominger-Buffa story. It's the number of ways you can deform that intersection. And as for the tension, it's just the D3 brain tension integrated over an appropriate cycle. Right. I perhaps should have mentioned here that Pendelzayas and Bushel had some preliminary calculations having to do with plane waves and these types of black holes on which we, of course, built. Okay. So what's really weird in the story is that as soon as you introduce two charges, then the supersymmetric guy looks like this. Supersymmetric black hole is still singular. But when you turn on some non-extremality, it's still singular. Up until some finite non-extremality mu sub c. This is the dimension gap. This picture is very easy to verify. If you stare at this equation, you just have two terms here. Then the most singular term at small r is where you have q1 and q2 over r to the fourth inside here. And clearly that's more positive than anything else at small r. That's why this picture looks the way it does. Okay, so this is in a way an old observation. The people who wrote down the solutions knew it. But the real point is that in CFT it tells you something rather surprising, that when you look at operators with a certain R-twist, there just aren't very many. There's clearly some corresponding to the supersymmetric state. I have no doubt that there's a few for, say, finite values of the R-twist. But then, somehow, when you get to exactly this difference, this critical dimension gap, above that gap, there is a huge entropically many number of operators. And that simply remains a puzzle. I would say it is an illustration that ADS-CFT still has many secrets. Well, I said I would finish early, and I really will here. ADS-CFT exhibits a lot of the amazing features that we've learned about gauge dynamics over my lifetime. And an example of that is this confinement without a mass gap for very natural physical reasons, similar, as I alluded to earlier, to the reason why pions are way below the mass gap in QCD. And although this is lovely, it just reminds us that supergravity has various ways of telling us that we need to go beyond it in order to really understand large end QCD. We have to do string theory in these backgrounds. The way supergravity told us this fact today was that picture where I had a compression of scales that, in order to separate the Goldstone boson away and decouple it, I had to go far, far away from the supergravity limit. And finally, this phenomenon of the dimension gap certainly shows us that we have much to learn, even now, about the simplest of interacting quantum field theories. Thank you.
We have plenty of time for questions. Question about this massless mode. So does that come from a two-form potential? It doesn't look like it does when it's off-shell. That's what I'm wondering, so I'm sort of puzzled about it.
Do you mean the Goldstone mode?
Yeah, the mode that, yes, you wrote down, so, in the supergravity language.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this, the main term to think about is DA is the star of delta F3. And delta F3 is DCD.
Yeah, delta F3 was star DA, right?
Yes.
Okay, and so that doesn't come from a potential unless it's on shell, right? Because it only satisfies D acting on it equals zero on shell.
Oh, I see. Well, plane waves would not present a problem.
Yeah, well,
you can certainly find a potential
for
that.
Momentum is.
But if you have a D string.
They're massless.
If you have a D string, then a sealer is no problem. You'd have to have some situation where.
Well, I'm wondering about an off shell momentum, for example. I don't think that would work.
An off shell momentum. I still think it would just be a supergravity mode, and you could do correlation function calculations in principle where one of these things was exchanged.
We should talk about it because I've been looking some at various of these modes in the compact case, and that's why I'm a little bit puzzled about this one. So.
Interesting. All right, I'll be eager to learn more.
Other questions? Comments? Don't be shy.
So what do you think are the chances of understanding better these deformed resolved conifolds which describe the baryonic branch?
Let me give you a pessimistic answer. I'm not even sure that the linear perturbation theory is right. We gave a linear perturbation that had all the right global properties, all the right global symmetries, broken Z2, et cetera, et cetera. We haven't really done the smoking gun calculation of writing down the supersymmetry variations and showing, for instance, that there's no dilaton. It's conceivable to me that there could be another mode, another modulus, that involves a dilaton. And until that's settled, I would be a little skeptical even about that. Maybe I'm too harsh. But as for the finite deformations, I think it's something we'll eventually get. I suspect, whether this is exactly the right linear mode or not, I think we'll eventually generalize it to finitely deformed conifolds, finitely resolved deformed conifolds.
Other questions, comments? State your name.
Harvey Rial. So these R charged black holes you've been discussing are all nakedly singular in the BPS limit. I just wanted to mention that if you also include angular momentum in anti de Sitter space, then it's possible to construct BPS black holes with regular horizons. Do you think your effective string picture could be useful in understanding those?
Yes, as I remarked to you in an email, I have the impression that this is a work in progress by Juan Maldacena and Justin Kinney, that they started completely independent of Jonathan and myself. So I not only expect it can, but I expect it will in HEPTH before too long. When I talked to Juan, it sure sounded similar. And it even sounded similar that they could calculate about what we could calculate. In other words, everything up to factors of order unity. That's a little disappointing, because I would have thought maybe near BPS limit, such as you described in your papers, that you would have better control.
Anything else?
So I have a question about rotating black holes in general. So do they correspond to gauge theory with finite chemical potential?
Yes, I'm thinking of small black holes in ADS. I believe I wrote it in the transparencies, but perhaps didn't emphasize enough. And it's important because I want to think about their microstates as dual local operators in the CFT. When you speak of large R-charged black holes, there's actually two things that are a little nasty. One is that, as you observed, then you should really think about a thermal bath with finite chemical potential for the R charge. So that's one thing that makes it a lot, in a sense, a lot harder than writing down local operators. The other thing that's awkward is that when these black holes are considerably bigger than the ADS radius, they would have a Gregory Laplace instability, as Inderjit Mitra and I showed some years ago. So I'm not even sure what that means in the gauge theory, except that this thermal bath has some spatial striping tendency.
Any other comments?
One small question. You say a small black hole is a 10-dimensional black hole or 5-dimensional?
We are thinking of black holes in 5 dimensions that are smeared over the S5. Does that answer the question? But as a matter of fact, the Gregory Laplace instability that I just referred to might have a tendency to unsmear it in the S5 directions as well as the S3 directions.
Why do you believe there should be an instability? Because I can turn on a chemical potential for the R charge and consider a large supersymmetric black hole in that case. It won't be, you know, it won't be the singular limit, but still, you know, would you expect there are some instabilities there?
Fine. Let's stay away from the case where there's simultaneously angular momentum in the S3 and S5 directions, because that's, as Harvey pointed out, that's yet another story. You're right that there's, for any Q, there is a supersymmetric one charge black hole that's singular but very close to black holes with horizons. I would say as soon as you turn on any finite non-extremality, the Gregory Laplace instability will kick in. And it's there, I claim, because if you just do the thermodynamics, the Hessian matrix of susceptibilities has a negative eigenvalue. But that negative eigenvalue may indeed go to zero as you approach the BPS limit. So the story can be consistent.
Okay, so why don't we thank Steve? And also the. So this ends this morning's session. Lunch is now served on the patio. We resume at 2 o'clock.